Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
You may be seated. Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals on the road. We really enjoy the opportunity to get out and come to a place like the law school, so we're really grateful that y'all are hosting us here, and hopefully the arguments that we have this morning you'll find interesting. We have two cases set for this morning. There will be a panel change after the first argument, so we will take a short break in between so that we can switch panels. Let me introduce the panel for this oral argument. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. I'm Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Dana Womack. And so without any further ado, I understand counsel's ready and has announced the times that they want to argue. So if the clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Valerie McNally versus Joseph McNally. And may it please the court, Mr. Thomas Michelle to argue for the appellants, Mr. Ed Huddleston to argue for the appellees.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Thank you for having us this morning.
Oh, I think your microphone might need to be. I doubt they can hear you in the back.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
We can hear you. I'm guessing they won't be able to hear you. Y'all are close enough to make me nervous.
Yeah. I can't really dodge.
We should be making them nervous. Well, while we're waiting to get the microphones fixed, how many of y'all in this room are students? All right, yay, okay, good. Well, we're gonna have a little opportunity for Q&A, I believe, after the arguments.
There we go.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Working. All right.
It might just be me. Thank you, may it please the court. Thank you for having arguments this morning, and.
Yeah.
Y'all okay?
Thank you.
Okay, great. I think we have an interesting issue here before the court. Maybe that's why they picked this case. For a brief set of background facts, we are here today from an appeal from an order granting a summary judgment declaring my client's lien invalid, a lien that arose from a divorce over 30 years ago in 1984. Brief background is the parties, Valerie and Joseph, were married in 1974. As community husband and wife, they acquired community property. Together, they had a child together named Kelly. And in 1981, they together had a contract to build a homestead for themselves, a house for their marriage and for their child. In 1984, a divorce was filed by Valerie seeking a divorce. The parties entered into a settlement agreement in 1984 relating to the division of the marital estate, and then entered into an agreement relating to the children. Pursuant to that agreement, they executed five documents in May of 1984, a quitclaim deed, a warranty deed, a promissory note, a deed of trust, and a deed of trust to secure assumption.
Yeah, let me ask you about those documents.
Yes.
It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that all the debt has been paid off on this property. Is that correct?
As of right now, we don't know.
So,
based on the summary judgment record, after 30 years.
So there's nothing in the record that would...
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. How about the debt, the deed of trust to secure assumption?
Correct.
That's been paid off, hasn't it?
Well, that deed of trust, I don't know that that was paid off.
Okay. But that document that your client executed, that was the one that had the express vendor's lien in it, correct?
Okay. The deed of trust, correct.
Right.
They both had the lien in them. They both, and with regard to the deed of trust, it had the express language in it within the body of it that said that this was made pursuant to and in part of the divorce settlement. which was then found by the trial court to say that the parties have entered into a settlement agreement. The trial court made that finding in its final decree that it approves the settlement agreement.
Do you have any cases? I'm just curious,
yes,
because I'm not familiar with a situation where, I mean, you see it all the time where parties get divorced and one side or the other gets the existing equity at the time of the divorce.
Correct.
Assigned to them, or the other party buys them out or whatever, or they get an OLT lien, I guess. Is that the right way to say it?
That is the correct
way. I need first-year property students to tell me if it's OLT or some other way. But but I haven't ever seen a situation where someone has almost like a springing equity that is going to come into existence decades, potentially, down the road. So how was the trial court didn't spell any of that out.
Correct.
In the divorce decree.
Correct.
So do you have a case where you can have this future equity determination?
Not specifically with regard to that. There are oftentimes, we're not a case that discusses the springing equity per se. However, I think that's getting a little bit of the cart before the horse. Because in this situation, this was an agreed upon division of the marital estate, an agreed upon written signed documents, five documents that are all executed on the same day, then approved by the court. The reason why I think this gets to answer your question before that, I'll get to that in a moment, is that we don't know what the equity was at the time these documents were signed. We don't know what the market value was of the property back in 1984. Every case they've cited challenging those are where you have to have the amount of the lien equal to the amount of the interest in the community property is based on a direct appeal. There's a reason why we don't collaterally challenge agreed final decrees of divorce, agreed liens 30 years later, and we've cited cases that you can't do that. You can't look to extrinsic evidence. You can only look to the face of the record to see whether those are valid or invalid.
How are we to know what settlement agreement the trial court approved?
We don't know. We have the existing real property documents, the promissory note, and the deeds.
Is there any requirement that the agreement has to be not just referenced, but it has to be knowable for the judgment to actually be effective?
I am unaware, and neither side has cited any cases invalidating these agreements. Once again, this is a collateral attack. It's not the same standards don't apply with regard to a direct appeal. You only look to the face of the record.
Well, now, is the appellee correct that only your client had counsel at the time that all this was going on in 1984?
Yes. That is our understanding based on the record by Gary Westenhoven, a lawyer out of Parker County. He prepared documentation. Now, once again, both sides have submitted factual backgrounds and history in the record in their summary judgment. We elaborated the reasons why. My client graciously gave up her interest in the property, took nothing from it, put it in a trust for the benefit of their mutual child, and didn't take a dime out of this property settlement other than the personal property she got.
Well, but I guess you could say she was kind of betting on the come in the sense that Mr. McNally's paying off the debt now because he's assumed the indebtedness.
Correct.
And she, you know, if her lien is valid, she stands to get, or the daughter stands to get half of whatever the net proceeds are upon sale or upon Mr. McNally's death, which could be a lot of money.
Possibly. We don't know. You don't go back and challenge behind the face of the record. And the reason why is we don't know what the market value was at that time. Don't forget, Mr. McNally has been living and getting the benefits of that land for the past 30 years. He has reaped the benefit of his bargain. What has Valerie gotten out of this divorce?
Well,
That's why equity imposes a lien, even if the court, two things, even if for some reason the court were to declare the underlying agreed upon, signed, and bargained for exchange that man made 30 years ago and then created a trust for the benefit of their daughter, if the court were somehow to strike that the man should be able to escape and get scot-free from not having to fulfill his written obligations, But then the Texas Supreme Court has also said a lien arises by implication.
But do we not at the end of the day, we're going to have to decide whether your client's lien was voidable or void,
correct,
or neither one.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
If it was a void lien, would you agree with the appellee that that he can challenge it at any time?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I will say, if the cases they cite are all direct cases, as the court knows, I do this quite a bit, and when you do the oilty liens, you try to draft them for the amount of the community property interest. If he was unhappy with that, and if he thought that was an unfair obligation, although he agreed to it, his remedy was to appeal it 30 years ago.
Have y'all tried to settle this since it has been 30 years ago?
As the summary judgment record shows, the first time this hit was about 30 years later.
Right, but have y'all tried to settle it since?
Since
then,
yes,
came
we have.
Up?
We've gone to mediation twice.
I mean, not that that's either here or there. I'm just curious.
Yes, we have.
Would it not be correct, though, that let's say, well, first off, have you objected to the representations of counsel in brief that, in fact, what the amount owed on the debt was at the time of the divorce? You're well aware of the rule that facts that are asserted in a brief that are not objected to can be assumed to be true by the Court of Appeals. Do you know whether or not you've objected to the representation?
I thought we did, but there's no evidence in the summary judgment record, and we have specifically objected and cited to the court this court's opinion and the other courts of appeals opinions that you can't look to extraneous evidence to try to prove up a fact that's not in the record based on the face of the record. That is in our reply brief. Remember, he's the appellee, so our first chance to respond to that is in our reply brief, which we specifically objected and said you cannot look to this extrinsic evidence to make an allegation that this was the alleged equity, that this was the alleged payoff.
Are the original documents to the Weatherford Bank and to the veterans, are those original documents in there that would show us what the term of that debt was?
For yes.
Purposes of, we don't know whether it's been renegotiated or not, but
correct,
we would at least have those in there and say that that's a 30-year loan or something of that nature.
Absolutely, yes. Those loan documents are in the record. You can look at those. What we don't know is between the time they purchased the property, what the value of the property was worth at that time. What we don't know was 3 years later, after they improved the property and created and increased the market value of the property, what the value of that property would be. All speculation. What his opinion is speculation, nothing in the record. And I know I'm kind of a broken record now. We can't look behind the face of the record.
Well, the record does, in fact, does it not show that the deed of trust that was actually done with regard to the quitclaim really isn't an issue here because that dealt with a property that isn't part of the homestead, correct?
Correct.
Okay, except for the 2-acre carve-out.
Where the house was built,
which
correct
is specifically named in the other deed, the warranty deed.
Correct.
Okay. Does not the warranty deed specifically say that the consideration that's being paid for purposes of the transfer is the assumption of the debt?
In part and other valuable consideration.
It just says the catch-all language and other valuable consideration.
Correct.
Okay. Let's say there's, just hypothetically, there's very little left. I mean, there's very little been paid. There's very little equity in the homestead whatsoever. It's $83,000. Maybe there's $4,000 or $5,000 of equity. So if the effect in that hypothetical would be that your client is deeding over her obligation to pay the debt, okay, deeding her interest in order to avoid her obligation to pay the debt. And over the next some odd years, it gets paid at that point in time. But if he happens to sell it the next day, well, the purchaser who comes in pays off the $83,000 debt or the $78,000 debt, and then all that's left is splitting up whatever the excess is as the community property at that point in time the very next day.
Correct.
Okay, so it clearly anticipated that he would have control over how equity would be built in the property, but it also established how equity would be distributed in the event of a sale.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. The obvious, as you can glean from the underlying documents, the intent or what they're trying to do was not to force him to sell the homestead that he wanted to be able to buy her out without costing him a penny at that time, to allow him to spend the next 30 years living and enjoying that homestead without having to pay a penny. He has received the benefit of the bargain. He's enjoyed this piece of land for 30 years, and he's not paid a penny.
Getting into, I guess, more of the specific legal issues.
Yes.
Your client, as I understand from the briefing, it either needs to be, in order to be a valid lien against Homestead.
Yes.
It either needs to be a purchase money lien or an OLT lien, correct?
Correct.
Now, you've talked about not going behind the record, and I admit that my knowledge of OLT liens,
yes,
is quite old, because it's been a while since I was in law school and haven't had to give them another thought since then. But isn't it true that you have to have, for a valid OLT lien, don't you have to have something in the record somewhere about the dollar values? Because isn't it designed to make up for an imbalance in the split of partition of property? We don't have a partition here, do we?
I would say no, there's no support for that. You have to have the expressed dollar amount. In fact, they arise by implication. They could be determined, but once again, I know that
Do they arise by implication, though? I mean, because it seems like there's very specific language that's required if you're looking at land title law for an OLT lien to arise.
Well, there's no requirement in either the Constitution or the statute that the specific dollar amounts be stated in there at all. So the only place that could possibly come from is from case law. Not stated in either the Constitution or the Chapter 41 of the Property Code. On the OLT lien, what the case law has developed is that to meet constitutional muster, either under the purchase money or the OLT, is what they're trying to get at the same obligation is secure the amount of the interest in the community portion that is being conveyed by the other spouse to somehow equal that. In the normal sense, on those cases they've sent that, if you can show from the record, from the trial court, which on the cases they cited, it was in the record, they had evidence to show that the amount of the money that was awarded as the money judgment exceeded the community interest in that homestead value. Here it's devoid. We don't have the market value. We don't have the community property interest. You can't come in and go behind the go behind the divorce decree.
Thank you very much.
I'm guessing that was the
Yeah.
Yes, that was our red light. We're using a slightly different timing system here today. Okay, Mr. Huddleston.
I thought those voices could come back in my head again. I'm Ed Huddleston. I've been accused of working at Las Vegas for a while. I represent Mr. Joseph McNally in this case, and it has been the way this case is perceived. It's now swerved off the road back down into the bar ditch, and we're talking about divorce issues. It's just so that there's no question whatsoever. The lien about which we speak is a lien on behalf of a trust that expired and terminated when the daughter reached 21. It's not a lien on behalf of Mrs. McNally. There is no transfer of Mrs. McNally's community interest to anyone other than Mr. McNally on May the 16th. There was a quit claim and there was a deed of, was a general warranty deed that retained, as he said, a vendor's lien, and there was a deed of trust to secure assumption, which secured the payment of that lien.
Mr. Huddleston, if in fact, as you represent in your brief, the only consideration really contemplated by the parties in the transfer of her community interest on these properties to her husband was that she would avoid whatever debt was in existence at the time with regard to those properties, then what was the point of having the language in the agreement that there would be a distribution of excess proceeds upon the sale of the property. There's no point to that unless there was an anticipation that she would receive a distribution when the property was sold.
There is absolutely not one single sentence in the record that says she will receive a distribution of the equity. It's not there. There is a deed of trust to secure what's called a note to the trust for the benefit of the child. The lien was for the benefit of that trust.
So the general warranty deed and the quitclaim deed, which were the actual transferring documents of her interest to him, okay, there's no other agreement that those two things effectuate with regard to the transfer. She just signed off on them, and the only consideration, as far as you're concerned, was the avoidance of the debt.
Well, that, and she received, as I don't know whether, if you look in the decree, she got three specific numbered paintings and whatever was in her hands. But we
don't know what those were worth. I mean, you said that they were valuable, but is there anything in the record
absolutely
that shows their
not.
Value?
What I do know is the divorce decree did not create any liens for anybody. And it was only specific as it dealt with those three paintings, and I just made the assumption that they were valuable. They were at least valuable to her. But
could have been sentimental.
Yeah, maybe they were childhood paintings for all
well,
I know.
Well, let me ask you this, slightly off topic. If the liens are invalidated, does Mrs. McNally, or Mrs. whatever her name is now, still have the note? In other words, would she still have basically an unsecured note? But you're saying that the promissory note itself goes away?
Well, that of course was not before the court below. But my in fact, you use the word springing. Anytime you hang around with dirt lotters, sometimes those things stick to you. That wasn't really a promissory note from Mr. McNally to the trust. It was a springing interest back to him as a result of a restriction on his rights to will his property. Effectively, if you read the trust and understand that the young lawyer that represented Mrs. McNally had been out of school about a year, a good man, I know him well, but if you read that trust, there's the trust is funded if and only if Mr. McNally croaks off before the girl becomes 21. He didn't die. She became 21. So this so-called promissory note, as we all know, a promissory note generally speaks, I will pay you X amount of dollars at this interest on this date. Didn't say that. It said, should he die before she gets to be 21, the net, and the words are net equity, half of the net equity, excuse me, will be paid to the trust for her benefit. All Mrs. McNally was on that trust was the trustee. And we all know that the trustee doesn't own anything. The trustee holds whatever might be there. Well, there wasn't anything there. It was never funded. So, and the only reason we spun off on these divorces in the first place was because the trust, the entity that owns the lien, didn't sell any property. Didn't supply any purchase money, didn't own a tax lien, didn't improve the property, and more importantly, that trust wasn't married to anybody, and they were not, the trust was not a party to that divorce. So,
but it was in fact created before they effectively became divorced.
Not really. Well, I don't know what it was created.
The divorce decree's in July, and even your own brief says the deed of trust for the benefit of the July trust.
Right, it was on May 16th. It was May 16th.
So all of the agreements that we're talking about here were entered into before the court actually entered the divorce decree.
Now,
the decree and the trust agreement appear to be dated the same day.
They're dated the same day.
Does that make it significant? Or
I don't think it matters in the least. I don't think any of that matters because it's an invalid lien. It's as if we went down to the bank and said, I want to buy a new truck. Banker, loan me some money for a new truck. And the banker loans us money and makes a lien on my homestead. Same thing. Bankers, lawyers, and loan sharks, since time immemorial, have tried to figure out a way to put a lien on a homestead. They've just done that. And an old lien arises either in a partition context. I just did one down on the river, and you couldn't split it up and be equal because you had road frontage, you had river frontage, and you had a cemetery. And so there was an old lien for the part you couldn't split equally. Well, in this case, it just never came to that. It just never came to that. And in the record, there is some evidence, and nobody ever fought it because it didn't matter at the trial court. But when they refinanced to build the house, don't hold me to the exact numbers, but I believe the note was $83,600, and the payoff on the divorce time was $82,400. I believe I'm right. So the difference between the two was about $1,200. And let me say, I bought a house in that same area about the same time for about the same interest rate, and an $83,000 note was a pretty big note in those days.
Well, okay, but if the equity in the property was teeny tiny at the time of the divorce, couldn't Mr. McNally have bought her out for the net equity at the time pretty easily?
Mr. McNally was unrepresented. And the documents that were executed are not ambiguous. Her lawyer drafted the decree. Her lawyer prepared all of the documents. Her lawyer could have easily, if it was for Mrs. McNally, he could have easily included into the quit claim and the warranty deed that he was only going to get half of it. But he didn't do that. You know why? Because Mr. McNally probably would not have assumed an $83,000 debt if he was only going to get half of it later, and he's going to have to pay off for all of it.
Well, how did this come up in 2014? What happened?
I was going to get to that, but the thing kept going off in my ear. Basically, Mr. McNally, and there is some evidence in the record that Mr. McNally paid the underlying debts. There's no debt left paying.
Is that part of the summary judgment evidence?
Yes, ma'am. It's... I think it's the there was about a dozen. Okay, I'm third string lawyer here. First guy died, second guy retired, and I think they won. but I believe in the first affidavit there was. Don't hold me that. I can't pull it out.
But anyway, so what happened in 2014?
Okay, so roughly 2014. Mr. McNally now has served his country, has had a second career, and it's time to, as we all do, start that renovation of the old body. And having things fixed here and things fixed there, came time to get a loan on the property. And come to find out, there were several things filed of record, including a memorandum of trust and a deed to the trust on his homestead.
Did he not get served with copies of those instruments at the time of the divorce?
I don't think so. Some of them, if you look at those things, they're just helter-skelter. Some of them were filed way down in December. I believe I'm December. Don't hold me to that. But long after the decree. I mean, I think when you take $400 for a divorce, maybe you don't do it that day. But there's not a rhyme or reason when they were filed.
So that's how he came to.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a fellow that was in the military and legal matters about having your chain of title screwed up was not something at the top of his head. So at the end of the day, he found out and he went to his wife. You know, simply that was who he divorced, and then he figured out. Bill Cantrell. He went to Bill Cantrell to figure out how to get out. I'm sure most of you know Bill passed last year sometime, and the ex-wife said no. Obviously, there had been some unpleasantness over the years, and so to clean up, the only thing you can do is you file a lawsuit to remove cloud on title.
Okay, counsel, the, on the exact same day, based on the schedule that you've got in your brief at page 4, there were 5 documents executed. One's the warranty deed.
Yes, sir.
One's the quitclaim deed. Right. One is the deed of trust to secure the assumption of the debt.
Right.
And then you've got the deed of trust, which you refer to as the deed with regard to the July trust, and the note to the July trust.
Right.
Now, you've kind of said that that's not really a promissory note, but
it's an obligation.
My understanding is it's an obligation from the husband to the wife. Hang on.
I got you.
To the wife, but not to the wife individually, but to the wife as trustee for the daughter.
I don't want to pick bones with you, Judge.
Well,
but we have in the past. But when you're trustee,
because I'm trying to figure out.
I understand.
You're saying there's just no obligation here whatsoever.
Right.
But the parties signed 5 different things, and if it was some bad lawyering by the attorney, then that's fine. But the bottom line is it purports to be an obligation of your client.
Right.
To his wife, but in a capacity that is not her individual community member capacity. It's in her capacity as a trustee for the daughter.
Okay. It would not be an obligation to the trustee. It's an obligation to the trust, the entity. The trustee gets nothing. The trustee has nothing. I mean, it's like, I'm sure you've served as a trustee on a deed of trust for banks and whatever. You don't get anything.
Fortunately, no.
Oh, so. God love you then. I have, and it wasn't fun. That's why I said I don't think the divorce really has a whole lot to do with it. We have a bare bones lien to a third party on a homestead.
Would this have been different had this been just a straight-up promissory note from husband to wife as part of the quitclaim and general warranty deed, okay, which evidenced an obligation to pay, all right? And then after the divorce decree, if wife wants to take that obligation, create a trust with that obligation, and act as a trustee, then she still has a lien on, she would in fact have an ulti lien at that point in time, but she's transferring it into a trust for the benefit of her daughter.
Well, you've asked a lot harder question than I can comprehend, but I don't think so, because here's what would have to happen if you just want to add a bunch of
ifs. You're not taking the position that ulti obligations can't be transferred, right?
First, you have to have an ulti.
I understand. You're not suggesting that they can't be transferred in some way. That's why I'm trying to see if there's maybe a temporal demarcation that may be relevant here. And
I escaped. I'm not going to answer that question.
Thank you. We keep the trains running on time at the Second Court of Appeals. Okay, Mr. Michelle, you have 5 minutes.
In fact, I think you answered some questions like that one time before that I got away with.
Thanks, Ed.
You can answer.
Yeah. In response, Justice Birdwell, the capacity issue, I think it's a red herring, but you're exactly right. Trusts are not entities. You have to put them in the trustee who is in the capacity of the child. And obviously, when you look at the record, on the face of the record that is before the trial court, and which is now before this court, there were the 5 documents that were executed all on the same day. The promissory note was made payable to Valerie L. McAnally as trustee for Kelly Alana McAnally. The parties' children, not her child, their child. And you're exactly right. It does specify the principal amount and the way it is to be paid. Once again, nothing is out of the odd or unusual.
And there's no trust until there's an obligation created by the final divorce decree, which is why the trust agreement is executed on the day of the divorce decree.
Correct. I mean, it's a very nice, I mean, I think it's a very nice gesture on behalf of Valerie to place her interest of the community into a trust for the benefit of the party's child. She should not be being punished for that.
So I'm looking at the trust agreement itself.
Yes.
It looks like in Article 4 that when Kelly or Alana, I've seen her referred to both ways, turns 21, then she gets the trust corpus, which is simply this promissory note, correct?
Correct.
So does Valerie even have any claim to anything at this point?
We really don't think so. They sued both. They originally sued Valerie, and when I first got consulted on this, I go, well, they got to add Kelly, because I looked at the trust document. Exactly. It matured, and that's why they then amended their petition. I think they realized what they needed to do to try to clear their lien was to sue both parties. Our position is, Justice Kerr, regardless whether it's in Valerie's name or it's in Kelly's name, we want our lien to be upheld, and we want it to be determined to be valid. The reason why I keep going back to these, because I've handled a number of these appeals with oilty liens, but they're all direct appeals. And we've cited the cases where you've got to challenge, we cited a federal district court that you've got to challenge the amount of the lien inside the underlying appeal. You can't collaterally challenge it later, which makes logical sense. If he has a complaint that the lien amount was not correct, that is an appeal, a direct appeal. It does not void, and they cite no cases that void it. Now, what happens if they're saying the lien's too much? You're remanded back to the trial court for the entry of the lien that's the correct amount. 30 years later, we can't do a remand.
I was going to say, I mean, because I'm troubled by the fact that there's nothing in the record to give us some hint about what the equities were, what the value, market value was at the time of the divorce.
And Justice Kerr, I understand that. I don't think this court should be troubled by that because you deal with the record that you're presented. This was an agreed, remember, one reason why there's probably not anything in there because this was an agreed deal. They signed 5 documents and a trust document and the court approved it and found it. You can't collaterally attack it 30 years later. The reason why is because we have all these questions. These would have been brilliant questions to take up on a direct appeal and look at the sufficiency of the record.
Is there any
The court's not even allowed to look behind the face of the record.
Is there any interrelationship? I'm assuming that Kelly was a minor at the time of the divorce.
She was a very young child,
okay.
Yes.
Is there any interrelationship between this settlement agreement, including the trust creation, and child support obligations of the father? And the reason I ask that is because one way that he would possibly be able to meet such obligations, if they're directly tied to the payment of a trust for Kelly, if that interrelationship is actually spelled out in the divorce decree.
There is nothing spelled out, and he was court ordered to pay child support. So I don't see any correlation between the two. There's the classic divorce. Granted, this is nothing like the 30 or 40 page divorce decrees we do now with children. This is like 5, but there are possession schedules and there's child support obligation.
And I guess the record doesn't tell because I noticed that he was ordered to pay $175 a month.
Correct.
And maybe sitting here today, that doesn't seem like a lot of money, but I guess there's nothing in the record to suggest that was somehow less than his obligation otherwise would have been to take into account this note.
Nope.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. That oral argument was very helpful. And the case is submitted. So we will take a short break for a panel change, and 2 of the 3 of us will be back.
All right.